312-981-7200. We'll first introduce Mike Leonard, Patrick, because he brought in sandwiches once again for the four of us, including Iridian. Mike, you're a stand-up gentleman, a scholar, a federal defense attorney, and a sandwich provider. We love you.
As I said, off air, if I didn't bring the sandwiches in, I would go hungry. I'd be emaciated and might even be dead. So
because you're saying that we would never return the favor, or Patrick Dolan
exactly
wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know why Patrick's on the show. He just doesn't care about you, John. He just does not care. But I do have two shout-outs. First of all, Doughboys for the sandwiches. Mm-hmm. Who knew they made a sandwich?
Yeah, it sounds like a pizza place. Yeah.
I thought it was a slice joint. Okay, and then second, to Terry Sullivan of Altus Work Architects in Chicago, a very loyal listener, and they have the CTA project at Staten Lake. So not only is he a loyal listener, they got that huge project. They're the architects on the Staten Lake, which I was asking him, why is it going to take 5 years? But yeah, those things take a long time.
They do. If he can be a source for why it went from $50 million to $400 million over the course of 8 years of waiting for the thing, we'll chat about it.
Well, I hope he gets part of that $400 million and his company, too. We'll see.
It looks like it's going to be beautiful, though, when it's done. When it's done. Patrick Dolan, employment lawyer. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good. All good?
We should return the favor at some point.
I know, we should. I don't want to say I feel guilty, but I feel like, John, it's your turn next.
I mean, I'm the host.
So? I mean, you know.
If we're relying on Patrick, just calendar it for 2028. If the show's still on the air and we're still
alive. All right,
alive,
I'll do it.
Just
an
empty sandwich, because I did wings from Jake Melnick's a couple weeks ago for the crew. Why don't I do that in a couple weeks the next time the three of us are on
that
together?
Sounds fine. I do like the idea of a slice, though. Bringing in, yeah, that sounds great.
So I just offered to bring in food, and he now is changing
the
order.
He wants to change the order.
No, I was saying after your wings. That's cool. I'll do it.
As I said, John, Patrick's just not care enough about you. But is Melnick's wings, are they, I don't remember, are they boneless or traditional with the bones?
You can do either or, but normally I go boneless because I just feel like places don't have enough meat. But Melnick's is not that case. We did bone-in, and they always brought in food for Hamp and OB on the show, pre and post Bears. And so we were trying to replicate whatever happened after the Green Bay win to try and make it happen again for the Rams win. Didn't happen that way. But we got Jake Melnick's that Friday before, and it's incredible. Like, there's so much meat on the bone, which for a boneless wing, sometimes doesn't work out. So,
well, we have to do the postmortem on the Bears. I have to apologize because I didn't change venues at halftime like I did in
like
the Packers game. Packers games, I switched venues at halftime. They won. Didn't do it. Made a huge mistake. Sorry, Chicago.
Blame you. Blame you.
That was a good game. It was a winnable game, but hey, what a great season.
No, it's over. It was great. Are you kidding? It's incredible. Listen, I'm just happy we have hope. Like, these guys are really good. They're going to be even better. It's extremely exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the collective yell that went up when
my gosh,
he threw the bomb to Komet, who is, by the way, a St. Vider product, as I went, of course.
Yeah.
And but that was the collective scream. Everyone's
incredible.
Unbelievable.
The whole city of Chicago. And the fact that he didn't even celebrate, I mean, it was like kind of funny. He caught
the
ball.
He did the bat thing. You see that? He swings the bat.
It was incredible.
Yeah. It was great. Yep. Okay. And then after that, okay.
Now go Hawks.
Immediately, I'm thrilled that the 630 texted in. They said, looking forward to hearing my question presented today, that I believe it was Wednesday when they texted it when you were in with me when I was filling in for Lisa.
Okay.
So that's going to go to the top of the line. I have it right in front of me. 630 has a question for Patrick. If you are in sales and you make money next year for what you sold last, leaving in June 1st, I think there's a question of I left, but I sold something for the following year. Is there any way I'll get compensation for what you sold in the future? I guess it depends on how the compensation packages are written up.
It totally does. So you start with the plan first, and you're trying to figure out when you have the right to the money. Is it when the client or customer signs the deal? Is it when they pay? Is it when the product or service is provided? So you start there. It is entirely possible, and in my experience, happens a lot, where folks leave, and because of that pipeline, they do get paid for sales that actually close, or
the money comes in
or something like that after they leave. Happens all the time. The starting point is what that plan says, though.
Is it sometimes, by the way, if I didn't mention, Patrick's an employment lawyer. That's why we're asking him employment questions.
Thanks, John.
He's from Conti and Dolan, and he'll be on with Karen Conti tomorrow afternoon, right?
Yeah.
And, so if you want to try and get the money, though, for something you sold and left, it shouldn't be assumed that it's automatically going to come to you. I guess what I'm asking is it a good idea to call that company and be like, oh, hi, by the way, I need my commissions planned out for when I left for the things that I already sold.
For sure. So if you're going to get a separation release agreement, which sometimes you do, that's got to be in there. But even if you don't get any kind of agreement walking out the door, you should confirm it, at least in writing, about what you're entitled to in an email. Get them to confirm, yes, when this deal closes or when the money comes in or whatever is the trigger point for that. You've got to get them to commit to that, preferably before you leave. But all is not lost, John. If you don't, it's just something that needs to be addressed afterwards.
We are sale, and the 630 followed up with sales are this year. You get paid next year by commission is how it is set up. So then for sure you should get paid if it was sales this year, next year.
Yeah, that's what the plan says. Absolutely.
Okay. And then look at our listeners, the 847. Ditto, looking forward to my question being answered. Sorry, Mike, you're going to have to sit there a little bit longer.
He's got a sandwich to eat, so yeah, he's fine.
We got to discuss at some point the verdict relating to Bovino. So
we'll get there. We'll get there when we get there.
Okay.
I just want to, these listeners came Mike in from a, like, from a Wednesday show and want to get to it.
Chime in over there.
847 had chimed in on Wednesday and is following up now. Ah, if I'm an Indiana resident working in Illinois for an Illinois-based company, are they required to pay out my earned PTO when I leave?
So probably it's a little bit tough because if Indiana doesn't have that law requiring it and he's a resident of Indiana, the company may say, you know, Illinois law doesn't apply to you. I think if the company is based in Illinois, he's got a good claim that, in fact, he is entitled to accrued unused PTO payout when he leaves.
Don't most employee laws center around where the company's based and operating out of, not where you live?
Well, I would say yes, but it really depends on the person. If there's a dispute where the person lives, usually drives the quote-unquote choice of law clause. The law where you live is going to apply to you most of the time.
Okay. 312-981-7200. We have more questions for Patrick Dolan. But as Mike Leonard mentioned, there was a big local story about what's happening or what happened in Chicago about Gregory Bovino and a plot. But not guilty verdict. As you can hear, I'm stammering around. This means I'm going to take the commercial break right now, and then we'll set it up for you. It's Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Quick question, Patrick. Do you represent cases in Indiana? No, right? Or yes?
Oh, no, I do. I have clients everywhere.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
I didn't know. Do you have to be admitted to the bar in Indiana?
Not unless you're if you're litigating, you'll need local counsel and you'll be admitted for purposes of that case.
Oh, yeah, we talked about that last time.
But I have clients who I negotiate deals for, et cetera, in a whole bunch of different states.
No, that's good. We're getting some more employment questions, but let's do the case that was a big one in Chicago. A man accused of putting a bounty on the life of Border Patrol Commander Gregory Bovino found not guilty on Thursday. Mike, give us a little bit of the background of this case and your lay of the land with it.
Yes, so it was a federal charge, murder for hire. The allegations were that the defendant had allegedly solicited someone to take out Gregory Bovino, right? Mm-hmm. And so it got a lot of attention. It was charged in October. Interestingly enough, a defense counsel demanded a speedy trial, which is not the usual course in federal court.
I was going to say, when I saw that this case was already reaching a verdict, I was like, wait, this is from during Operation Blitz. We already have a federal case being decided. So that's a rapid process. But it's our right to do that, right?
Yeah. So in federal court, you can demand speedy trial. You don't usually do it because most cases are large. There's a huge volume of discovery. And therefore, you're way behind the eight ball. You know, the government's investigating a case oftentimes for anywhere from months to, in many cases, years. So they have all this. They're way ahead of you. They know what all the witnesses are going to say. You haven't reviewed the discovery. You haven't received the discovery. So normally you're not asking for speedy trial. But in a case like this, where it's a one transaction issue relating to text messages, that's kind of the premise of the whole case.
What was the evidence?
They basically presented evidence that the defendant had either sent text messages or other communications, which the government claimed was putting a bounty on the head of Bovino. But my understanding of the evidence, there was nothing to show that he or anyone else ever took any steps whatsoever, much less a substantial step, to do anything to him. So, you know, it was a great move by defense counsel, the law firm of Betty and Singer. Great job. Got a not guilty jury verdict. The government's case was apparently pretty narrow. They didn't have a lot of witnesses that they put on. And it sounds like a great closing argument by defense counsel in that case. And, you know, that's a great law firm in criminal defense in Chicago, Betty and Singer. So hats off to them. And, you know, it's, as you know, statistically, it's somewhat rare to get not guilties in federal court. Statistically, you know, the government wins anywhere, and depending on the jurisdiction, anywhere from 80% of the time to, it could be as high as 95 or 98%. So it's good. And there's been a number of them in federal court not guilties over the last couple of years. But the big question is, you know, if you could talk to the jury, which in federal court you don't have a right to do as an attorney. You're barred from doing that,
mm-hmm.
Unless that they wanted to talk to you, right? That's their right if they wanted to talk to you, but they haven't spoken. But, of course, everyone believes behind the scenes that, you know, suspects that there'd be an influence on the anti-ICE sentiment in Chicago. You would think would have a impact on the minds of the juries, even though, of course, they're told they can't consider that. They can't consider their feelings about ICE. They can't consider their feelings about Trump or enforcement here in Chicago. Of course, they're instructed on that. But, of course, as a lawyer, you know that people are people, and, you know, their viewpoints are going to have some influence in the jury room, even though they're not going to be able to speak of them, and they're never going to say that they directly consider that. But, of course, if you're a defense counsel, this is an environment where probably be more friendly to you than otherwise.
Patrick, you had a follow up?
Yeah, I just want to, for point of law, Mike, in terms of the standard. So what would have had to have happened for this solicitation to be sufficient for a guilty verdict? Do you know what I mean? Like what kind of action or step needed to happen to sort of get over that hurdle?
What would rise it above gossip to an actual crime?
There'd have to be something, you know, merely making a statement. Even if the statement was on his face, like, hey, $10,000 for Bovino or something like that, okay, you know, there's many ways to explain that. And then still, you're going to have to show that something was done to give it a level of seriousness, that there's some substantial step taken towards that, which there was no evidence that anyone did anything, is my understanding of the evidence.
In fact, the prosecutors at some point had said that he was a higher-ranking member up in the Latin Kings, and the judge would not allow that to be presented in the case because the prosecution could not show that he was.
Correct. And, you know, gang affiliation or membership is often a critical issue in lots of types of prosecutions. You know, whether it comes in, whether it doesn't, it's extremely prejudicial. Although, you know, people hear about that gang affiliation a lot. So, you know, sometimes it's not as prejudicial. But in this case, I think it clearly would have been
especially if it's someone that is maybe the prosecutors would argue you're connected to an organization that has access to weapons, could do something like this.
Correct.
You could make the case that, well, yeah, if he's a high member in Latin Kings, when he says that, it's different than just an average Joe on the street saying it.
Yeah, and that would be the government's argument. So that evidence was excluded, which was obviously a good ruling for the defense. But yeah, I mean, the overall thing is, you know, typically cases don't go to trial that quickly. I can't talk about the substance of a case. We're actually on Monday making a speedy trial demand in a case that was pretty recently charged, which again is unusual, but it's has some similarities to this case in that it's a narrowly focused case based upon a particular communication. And so we want the case to go to trial. The guy doesn't want to sit in a federal jail for months and months when the evidence is really pretty narrow.
Given that all that you said about the jury makeup in Chicago just a month after Operation Midway Blitz ended in Chicago, which carried with it a lot of negative headlines and feelings, not 100% across the board, of course, but a lot of that was in the city. Why didn't the federal government try and move the trial to somewhere where they felt like they could get a more impartial jury? Would that be unusual?
That would be highly unusual, almost unheard of. I mean, the opposite happens on a somewhat regular basis, but it's a really hard showing to make. So to get a change of venue based upon pretrial publicity, you have to make an extremely high showing. And, those motions don't happen a lot in federal court. They happen in state court. And in state court, they're routinely denied. I had one denied last year. I have one pending right now in a downstate case. But you have to make such a substantial showing that it's basically permeated the community, so there's no way you could get a fair cross-section of the community on the jury. The government asking for it almost never happens because, look, the things that are in the press are not pro-defendant. You know, all that's been written about this case has been negative about the defendant. It wasn't pro-government. So,
wait, you're saying that because the press releases released by the government are obviously making a strong case against the defendant, and the news reports somewhat regurgitate what is written and put it out there. So you could make the argument that no, even though it was maybe an unfavorable environment to Operation Midway Blitz on the whole, the government has been the only one speaking on this, and they have peppered the journalists with a lot of regurgitated paragraphs.
Oh, yeah. Think about how this goes. I mean, so first of all, there's an indictment returned in any case in federal court, and then they do a press release, and then they go sometimes on TV. And then the press repeats that press release and what's been said on TV, and then repeats things that are filed or the basis of motions in court. So it's almost never the case that the publicity towards the defendant is positive. It's not. And so if anyone were to Google the case on the jury, they'd see story after story about a murder for hire plot. It would make it seem like the person may be guilty or is guilty. So it's very unusual to ever have a case where the press coverage is such that it favors the defendant so much that the government could get a change of venue. That's almost never happened.
So the feds would want to stay in the venue.
Oh, yeah. They don't want the case to go somewhere else.
Okay. We got to take a break for the news. More questions coming in about employment law. Those will be guided towards Patrick Dolan, federal defense attorney, or other stuff will be guided to Mike Leonard and everybody else, in fact. Appreciate you joining us. Patrick, are you having problems with that chair right now? What's happening?
No, I just wanted to stand up. I'm fine. Thanks, okay. John.
He was like,
I got some energy from that huge sandwich Mike brought in.
You've only had half, Patrick.
I know, I'm trying. Jeez, I got a ways to go.
Mike Leonard, we were talking earlier about the case of a Chicago man arrested and charged with a murder for hire plot against Greg Bovino. It went quickly through the jury, to the jury. The jury quickly reached their verdict of not guilty. We were talking about moving the venue because Chicago could be a more hostile environment, perhaps, to the federal government. You brought up a good point in the break. It's not just the city where the jury pool is pulled from, right?
Yeah, so the jury pool in federal court is a little surprising. So you might think, wow, the federal court's sitting in downtown Chicago. Gee, maybe the jury pool is the same as 26 in California, for instance. It's diametrically opposed. So the jury pool for federal court in Chicago goes all the way almost to Rockford, and then you have the Rockford court out there. So very far-reaching and rural.
Mike's got to clean his face for the sandwich.
And then all the way north to Wisconsin border and then to Indiana. So for a defense, from a defense lawyer perspective in federal court in Chicago, when you're trying a case, oftentimes you really believe that the pool is not representative of the community when you're representing someone of color, because it's not. You have a pool walk-in of anywhere from 30 to 60 people, and if you represent someone who's of color, oftentimes there's very few people of color because it's such a large pool, and we often make the argument it doesn't provide the appropriate cross-section of the community, which is very different than 26 in California because it is Cook County, so it's going to be a completely different pool. Much more diverse, much more a cross-section of the community in terms of race and color. We just tried a case there recently, and I actually couldn't describe the juries as more different in terms of the pool. So it's something we're up against all the time. The point being in this Bovino murder-for-hire case is that the assumption you guys were making was, hey, you know, there's such a groundswell of, you know, disrespect and non-support for ICE. Wouldn't that affect the jury pool? Well, maybe not. It's not just a bunch of people from Chicago. They're from rural areas. They're from Republican areas. They're from people who support ICE areas. So it's not like that. And so, therefore, it makes the result the defense counsel achieved probably even better and even more significant.
I have one follow-up point, and I'm sure you, just to put a finer point on it, you're not suggesting that someone of one race can't make a fair decision in a jury about someone in another race.
No, of course they can, but the constitutional requirement is a fair cross-section of the community, which ultimately comes down to the process by which people are selected for jury duty. But look, if you're someone of color and you walk into a courtroom and there's nobody of color in the veneer who you're picking from, that's troublesome, right? And of course it doesn't matter your race. Of course you could be fair, but if you're looking for a fair cross-section of the community, it would be concerning to anybody that, gee, there's nobody in this room or one person or two that looks like me. Is this really a fair cross-section of the community?
We saw this in the Jim Crow trials often, right? A very black community in Mississippi, a black defendant, and it's an all-white jury, right?
Correct.
And it's the standard is jury of your peers. It's a Sixth Amendment issue. But they don't really define, like, geographical boundaries of what the community is, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, the difficult thing in contesting that in federal court is you have to show somehow there's a flaw in the process that excludes in some way a racial group or some type of group. So that's hard to show oftentimes. And you see that in a lot of federal courts across the country because their geographic sweep in other cities, the same here. It's a very wide jury pool, which therefore then takes in lots of different people, and it might not look like the city in which the court is sitting.
Some people might argue that a community could be a broader range than just a city of Chicago, in that maybe it's a good thing that it is a wide-ranging viewpoints from a large swath of area like Rockford and Aurora and Chicago.
Yeah, good point. But obviously, you still want to, you know, you still want to see it represent.
Exactly.
If you're representing people of color, there's nobody there. That's troublesome.
It's
and
not
that's,
a perfect process.
Issue.
I will admit that. But there should be every effort made to make it look like a cross section of the community that exists. What that boundary of community is, we could argue. Okay, Patrick, I got some employment related questions.
Sure.
You ready to get some of these?
For sure.
224, I'm a 60-year-old woman, worked for my employer a long, long time. Lately, my supervisor's been asking questions about when I will retire. I'm a long way from retiring, 5 to 7 years at least. How do I answer this question? Should it even be asked? Great question here.
That is a really good question. So, you know, there's definitely an age discrimination concern there in the fact that the question's even being asked. You should just respond, I have no plans to retire. And as long as you're doing your job and doing it well and nothing should change, that anything like that could be pretty good evidence of age discrimination. So I would answer it like that. I have no plans to retire, and I don't see any reason why I would leave this job.
Okay, let's go to the phone lines. Ron, you're on WGN. Hello, Ron.
Hello. Patrick, this is for you. Recently, I heard that a lady was suing her former employer because of, I guess she didn't take the COVID test. Now, I know when I was working, they didn't say they would fire you, but they pretty much suggested, and I know people who did. So what was the fire? I thought that probably had been determined, some kind of ruling, because it's been a couple of years. So thank you as always.
That's a good question. And Patrick, it's a difference if it was the government telling you had to get the COVID shot, because I know that was a case for some employers that got fired. I think a lot of them have gotten their jobs back under the Trump administration. But private employers, what's the outcome on that?
So unless you have a good religious reason or a medical reason for not taking the COVID vaccine, an employer can and has, and I'm sure will again, discipline or terminate you for not taking that COVID vaccine. So, but the bar is really high in terms of a good medical reason or a good religious exemption, you know, to not take that vaccine. So those cases have not been successful challenging the vaccine on those grounds. So I would say most employers are well within their rights to terminate folks who are not taking that vaccine.
Okay. Let's go to Chuck. Chuck, you're on WGN. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, guys. I'm trying to help out my mother-in-law who worked for a large public utility my father-in-law who worked for a large public utility company and retired under an early retirement plan back in, like, 1997. And my mother-in-law was given medical benefits, supplemental insurance at that time, and recently they've changed that and they're no longer paying for that. They took it off. But the timing was really unfortunate. They sent her a letter sometime in December, and there was a number on there she called, and she didn't understand the letter that her insurance was ending, and she's going through cancer treatments.
Ugh.
And, you know, so she's, you know, they're saying, well, you know, you're going to have to pay for these because you're not covered. But, you know, for almost 30 years, they've been paying for this, and she's trying to find the papers from 30 years ago, what the agreement was with my father-in-law retiring early. He subsequently passed away. But, you know, it's, and this company is, they make hundreds of millions of dollars of profit. It's just horrific that they're doing this.
Chuck, that's terrible. Patrick, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I really hope they find that paperwork, because that should answer the question in terms of whether this company can change that ongoing benefit at any time. Chances are they cannot. And so, you know, without that agreement, listen, it's got to exist somehow.
Hold on. I know, but like keeping paperwork for 30 years is ridiculous. So can't you, as a lawyer, if you sue, force them to show their own paperwork?
Yeah, and I think I would even get that before suing. I think a demand letter simply asserting their right to that ongoing coverage and demanding that they produce evidence that allows them to pull that benefit is going to get you the agreement that you need to see. I don't have to sue to get that information. I'm almost sure.
Because if they've been doing it for 30 years, it should be up to them to prove that they said that they were going to be able to wiggle out of this thing. Because they've laid this assumption that it's for life if it's been there for 30 years, Patrick.
Yeah, they right.
The onus is on them to prove themselves, not on this poor woman to prove herself, in my opinion.
Yeah, the problem is right now she has to show a breach of contract, right? So we have to look at what the agreement says. But there's also some tort claims. Listen, it could be entirely unjustifiable. We just have to come up with the reasons why. It certainly seems unfair, but I can get the information that's going to answer that question.
Chuck, where do you live about? So I have a question.
This is in Northwest Indiana.
Okay.
Very large public utility company.
Oh, yeah. There. So here's what we're going to do.
One other piece of information. They refuse to talk to her now until they send her a letter because her phone number in their system was inaccurate. And we have to wait to get a letter before they'll even talk to us.
Yeah, Patrick Dolan will fix this.
Incredible.
So here's what I want you to do. I want you to call Patrick, number one. And Patrick, you remember this too. If this doesn't work out for whatever reason, Patrick, and they're going to deny her insurance, Chuck, I need you calling every media station that you know of, including right here, telling them this story. Because there's a lot of investigative teams, including over at Channel 9, that is a juicy story. Someone who has cancer, who has lived under insurance plans for 30 years that were guaranteed to her and her husband.
Husband, yeah.
The media pressure can sometimes change things too, Chuck. So I appreciate you not saying the name of the company here on this program, but I want you to follow up with Patrick. And if this goes nowhere, Patrick, you follow up with me and Chuck, and we'll chat, and we'll try and figure out a way to move the needle on this.
Happy to help.
That sound good,
Thanks,
Chuck?
Guys.
And you know what? I'm going to add something, John. So my mom's insurance is entirely because of my dad. And all of that supplemental benefit that went to her when he died is incredibly important. Listen, I would be very adamant if they pulled my mom's insurance under that scenario. So we'll look into this.
I don't care if they sent a letter.
No, that's not the end of this. That's not the end of this at all. That's just the beginning of this.
Like my fighting spirit, Mike?
Yeah, and typically, you know, you have to, in breach of contract cases and written contract, you have to attach it, but you could plead the facts and circumstances to show why you 100%. Don't have it. You could show the efforts made to get it. And, you know, one of the good pieces of evidence that supports the interpretation of the contract is the fact that they performed in the way that they have for 30 years.
Exactly.
Agreed. So, I mean, definitely a demand letter and then definitely possibly suit. But I like the idea of, John, bringing it to someone's attention because it is one of those stories that people would care about.
Everyone will care about it. I'm sure all of our listeners' blood was boiling hearing that.
It's ridiculous.
And how about everyone inundates that company that has hundreds of millions of dollars with phone calls? They'll make a different decision pretty quickly. That's how we that's using the power of media for good. All right, we're gonna take a break. More with these two guys, Mike Leonard and Patrick Dolan, after this break on WGN. 151 on WGN. John Hansen here, Sylvia Snowden. We'll have the latest news update in about 8.5 minutes. A lot of questions and concerns coming in. 630, though, just wanted to say, yes, John, shout it from the rooftops. That's from Sherry, in terms of the power of media for a story like the one we heard before the break about someone who had insurance under her late husband's early retirement package. Patrick, how rare is it for those things to creep up, like where they change the terms of the deal?
It's not rare at all. I mean, it happens a lot.
Like a breach of contract like that?
100%. Yeah,
they just assume they're going to get away with it because no one's going to say anything?
Yes, that's exactly right. Companies try to change benefits all the time when they shouldn't or when they're not allowed to under a contract, et cetera. So it happens a lot, John.
Okay. Would you have to file that as under ERISA or just a plain old breach of contract?
What does that mean?
There's the Employment Retirement Security Act, ERISA, which I was wondering if that would govern that or not, or whether it just be a straight breach of contract.
Not having seen the plan for this particular employer, I'm not sure whether it's an ERISA-covered plan. Probably just a breach of contract, but I don't know. It's possible.
Maybe we've generated a second case, Patrick.
An ERISA class action.
Yeah.
An ERISA class. Mike, let's do it together.
Let's do it, Patrick.
Let's ERISA. That would be
fun. We'll put aside our differences, you know, how much we hate each other off air.
Yeah,
and
we'll just
team up.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kidding.
Wait a minute. I'm really excited. This could be a class action. I mean, don't you think they did this to other folks in that circumstance?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Come on, Mike. Here we go.
I'm with you, Patrick.
Okay. Thanks, buddy.
Maybe John can be paralegal on the case.
Yeah. Well,
I'm too busy.
Sort of. Like, you know, he's going going to, nah. You know, he's not going to do any work.
You're not going to meet my quote. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 to get on the line.
Every dime.
I do want to say and ask you, Mike, one of the interesting aspects of what you do, obviously as a federal defense attorney, you represent a lot of people that are accused of crime, state or federal. You do whistleblower law, but you've started doing a lot more in the college circuit for kids that aren't really facing a court case per se, but an administrative hearing for something that they are alleged to have done, and you go and help them out during this hearing.
Yeah, so some of the cases where, you know, obviously a student at a university or college can be accused of a wide range of alleged misconduct, right? It can range for something that actually is a crime, so you have to kind of navigate the aspects of not saying something or doing something that would undermine your situation in a criminal prosecution, right? But most of the cases, probably 80% of them, are not things that would be crimes. They're relating more to academic misconduct. For example, the student improperly allegedly used AI in a wrong way or plagiarized something. So, yeah, so it's a defense of someone accused of something. So it's very similar to a crime, even though it's not pled as a crime against you. And so all these colleges and universities have their own processes, which, as we've talked about on the show, unfortunately are very limited. So but you do have the ability to present evidence. You do have the ability to testify on your own behalf, and you do have the ability to call witnesses. It just the role of the lawyer is different and more limited. You don't get in there and swing and cross-examine the people that are bringing forth the evidence against your student. But yeah, that's been an interesting practice area for us. That's kind of developed just over the last 2 years, and we've had some really significant wins in the last few months, including getting someone reinstated to a university job who was a student, and a case that got dismissed because someone was falsely accused of sexual misconduct, a case that got dismissed because someone was improperly accused of misusing AI. And that AI issue is so interesting because mm-hmm. you have professors who will tell students you can't even use it as a research tool, which makes no sense to me.
No sense. That's like saying like in the early days of Wikipedia, you can't use it.
Yeah.
Even though it's proven that you can use their sources and use it to write anything.
It's like saying you couldn't Google to get mm-hmm. references yeah. and materials or to come up with, okay, a topic or an outline. So it's really, that's kind of the Wild West still in terms of what's proper, what's improper, the AI usage. And of course, you know, it goes back to when I was a kid, John, and using the World Book. You know, you couldn't copy direct from the World Book, but you could certainly paraphrase and find information. So where that line is drawn by different professors within the same department, even teaching the same class, varies. So that's what makes it unfair, because you might have the same section of a class. And some professor may say, yeah, you can do whatever you want. You can use it as a tool. Another professor says you can't use it at all. And then the school doesn't have a consistent policy about what's you know, right and what's not. But one of the common things we face now is that these universities use things like, it's called Turnitin, these programs which they come back and say, oh, we think this paper is 14% AI, or this paper is 80% AI. And then when you look at the paper, you're like, that doesn't make any sense. And so there are these really blurry lines that are kind of going to be established over the next couple of years, but have made for a lot of cases at a lot of different universities across the country.
Patrick, you had something to say.
Yeah, what about the situations where what the student is allegedly accused of having allegedly done is both a crime and a violation of a school's code of conduct? Do those things run at the same time, or does a school defer to a criminal process, or how would that work?
Usually they don't, so that's a problem. Usually the school does not say, okay, well, let's see how the prosecution comes out, and then we'll go ahead with our student disciplinary thing. They usually do the opposite, and sometimes they'll take action preemptively against the student. They might suspend them even before you've really had a right to a hearing, or take other action against them while the process isn't completed. But the issue becomes, in a lot of those situations, like, can I really have my student, you know, make statements yeah. either in writing or at a hearing that might undermine their position in the criminal prosecution? A lot of times they're consistent. You know, they're denying the allegations, and they would deny it in the criminal proceeding as well.
Okay, Mike, how can people reach you if maybe their kid has been accused of something, they're facing a disciplinary issue at school, and you might be able to help them out?
312-380-6559. Yeah, for anything relating to that or to any state or federal criminal matters or investigations or potential charges.
Patrick Dolan's number at 312-332-7800. We were talking about law stuff, of course.
Oh, guys. Yeah. Deep, we deep about law.
That's all we talk about.
Law.
How long has this bed been playing, Iridium, before I started talking? Was it a little bit? 10 seconds? That wasn't too bad. I'm normally better about that, everyone. Hi.
I think you built tension.
I did build tension.
Are they going to come back? We hope they aren't. We hope they aren't.
Can we play something else?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, Hochberg stepped in the studio. I got a little of him rubbed off on me just there, not knowing how to run a radio show.
Here's the question, John. I mean, how long would that go on and people would have been very happy? You know, could have been till the next break. Like, wow, does that was refreshing.
Does the bed music outrate our program? I don't know.
That's a toss-up.
Let's actually not find out.
I don't want to find out.
Let's go to Eric.
Just keep talking.
Eric, I'm sure the suspense was building when he just heard music for 10 seconds. Hey, Eric, how are you today?
Yes, exactly. The suspense was building. I'm doing very well, thanks. I'm actually a personal friend of WGN's Karen Conti.
Oh, look at that.
She's given me some advice about this.
Okay.
But I'm retired from the fire department. I currently work on a semi-retired basis as a funeral director. And there are a lot of funeral directors who also hold law degrees. I've had a true love for the law for decades. And I just never was able to commit myself to going to law school. And I was wondering, at 62 years old, am I too old? I mean, I don't like driving at night anymore. I mean, I could handle sitting in a classroom naturally, but I just think, am I wasting my time? I don't want to waste my time.
Mike?
I say absolutely not. You're not wasting your time. I mean, it really comes down to, if that's really your passion and you really want to do it, absolutely. I mean, the only downsides or challenges are the financial cost. I mean, how much it costs, but, you know, maybe, particularly because your age, maybe that would even help you get more money from the school in terms of your tuition and scholarship and all that sort of stuff. But no, I mean, I think it's a fantastic idea if that's really what you want to do. When you were younger, like growing up, was it something that was on your mind? And what area of the law would you be interested in practicing when you would be done?
At one time, I was very interested in criminal defense.
Yes.
That's kind of waned, so to speak. But I wasn't able to go because of my work schedule. You know, we worked 24 hours on at the fire department. We were off for 48. And I was thinking, well, if I have class on a work day, there's no way I can attend.
Yeah, that's too hard.
And I'm just wondering, are there any, I hate to use the term correspondence schools, but, you know, online or e-learning for certain classes?
Go ahead, Mike.
There are law schools which offer that as a big part of it by doing it online. But even my understanding is that in law school, just like undergrad now, there's a lot of classes that are taped or whatever. But you could go at night, for example. Mm-hmm. You could wade in part-time to try to figure if you really like it and it fits your schedule. Some people go exclusively at night. But yeah, I think you could get some flexibility there. But since criminal law is not of interest, when you're done in a couple of years, probably 3 years or more, what area would you like to go into, do you think, or how would you use it for what you're doing now?
Well, as I mentioned, there's a lot of law in what I do as a funeral director, and sometimes there's more work for a family after the funeral than there is in actually planning the funeral. I've had people come up to me say, you know, we really need to find an attorney. We've got estate problems. You know, dad died without a will, and
right.
Family is fighting. And
a lot of stuff we cover on this show.
Exactly. And let me tell you, if anybody's listening to this, here's a word of advice from the undertaker. Get a will. And it saves so much hassle for the survivors. And you can take the nicest family in the world and throw a funeral into the mix, and 30 years of just, I don't want to say hostilities, that's a little strong of a term, but
tension.
30 years of feelings will come boiling over to the surface. It's like, I'll get a phone call from a sister, for example, or, you know, a daughter of the decedent saying, whatever you do, don't give my sister copies of the death certificate, because she's going to go and cash the insurance policy. We won't have enough money to pay you, and she's going to blow the money on booze at a bar or give it to her boyfriend. It's like, okay. Oh, yeah. And then about a half hour later, I'll get a call from the other sister saying, if my sister calls you, it's like, oh, I don't want to get in the middle of it.
So, Eric, here's my question. Do you want to maybe get your law degree and get maybe estate planning as one of your things so that instead of referring those people to someone else, you might be able to represent them in those situations?
Yes.
And that makes sense.
A lot of funeral directors do that already. They operate, you know, a dual law practice in a funeral home.
Yeah. Well,
Eric, you're allowed to do this, go to law school and do that as long as you advertise on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association at the end of it, of course. Go ahead, Mike.
Leonard. I do have one question for you. Have you been in the funeral director business long enough where you would know about all those cases that they had in litigation where people became members of the FDSA and then therefore got sued because they were in the union and didn't know it, all those cases? Was that before your time, or is that something you experienced as well?
That must have been before my time. I'm not familiar with any FDSA cases. The FDSA is basically the Teamsters Union.
Correct. Yeah, well, what happened, I was actually involved in a lot of those funeral home-related cases years ago, like in the mid-90s, late 90s. What would happen is people would join the FDSA, their funeral home, and some of them didn't know that, therefore, that meant they were bound by the collective bargaining agreement with 727. There was a ton of lawsuits over that for a period of like 10 to 20 years.
Wow.
So I became a bit familiar with your industry. But I think if you have the passion and want to do it, I'd say absolutely.
Plus, there seems to be a direct, I'm going to use this, using the networking I've already built to enhance my job, to bring me and my family more money, and to help out my customers in a more extensive way. It seems like there's a clear path here.
Yeah, and you know what, a couple things real quick. So Chicago is a great city for law schools because there are two or three law schools specifically that have part-time, night programs, classes online, stuff like that. This is a really good city for someone like Eric to go to law school. Secondly, John, you asked him if he wanted to use it to represent people. I was thinking maybe he might be interested in a master of law in like trust and estates or something like that. You don't get to represent people, but you have a lot of knowledge that can help. And so that could provide a substantive area of knowledge for him. But if he wants to be a lawyer and represent these people, then obviously he has to go to law school, pass the bar, etc.
True.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can reach out to some of these schools, like say, hey, I'm considering wading in here. You know, what do you offer? And what do you think,
someone
at my age? Because here, you know, obviously I'm looking for some flexibility. You know, what do you guys offer in terms of your night program? What's the ability to take classes online? Because my understanding is that that's something that is happening.
For sure.
And so I think, you know, reach out to some of these places that I'm sure they'd be excited to talk to you about it.
Eric had a follow-up question. Go ahead, Eric.
Oh, yes. Quickly, you know, I've read a lot of judges, written opinions on particular cases. It might be a 10-page opinion, and I get about a quarter of the way through, and I find myself rereading it to try and understand. And I'm thinking, all right, is this what I'm going to be in for? Am I essentially smart enough?
I think Mike Leonard's had to reread a couple cases.
Wow.
That is a
low blow. Yeah.
No, and you brought him a sandwich.
But how many Supreme Court cases have I read and gone, wait, hold on, let me rewind back here a couple paragraphs? I don't think that's a eliminating factor, Eric, for going to law school, right, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, one thing about reading those opinions, Eric, is that if you're not in law school, haven't gone to law school, you know, a lot of those cases start with a lot of procedural background. You know, for example, you know, the case is before the court because, you know, this motion was filed and this motion was granted, this motion was denied, or, some of them aren't even after trials. So all that procedural muckety-muck when you're reading, it's hard as a layperson to understand what they're talking about because it's a lot of the buildup to, okay, so now here we are. That's the procedural posture of why we're in this case. But I agree with you. A lot of those cases are difficult to understand. If you omitted the procedural background and started with the facts, I think that's helpful. But
suffice to say that just because you don't understand a judge's ruling all the time doesn't mean that you're not equipped for law school. Not at all.
For sure not. But I would just, let's not mislead
Eric. Final point. Go ahead.
Okay. It's a lot of reading. Okay. And let's not mislead Eric. But he'll learn how to look at that stuff and make sense of it. That's part of law school.
Eric, right. Go for it, buddy.
That's law school.
Yeah, do it. So. For sure.
Eric Patrick's
right. Well,
got that law clerk job
the,
waiting for you.
Time, so I appreciate your insight on this.
Yep, absolutely. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon. Keep us posted on the process.
Good luck.
I want to read to the 520 texted in, and this is interesting. The text just disappeared. Here we go. I'm 73. I'm in law school.
Awesome.
It's what I'm doing with my retirement. I love it. And now that I don't have to work, I feel like a college kid again. I read cases 2 to 3 times, recommended by professors. Loving it. How awesome is that?
Yeah, I wonder where the person goes. I would just say, look at John Marshall. It used to be John Marshall, Mike. Now it's UIC Law School. They have a lot of good programs that might work for Eric.
Would 520 by any chance be interested in calling in?
I don't know. I can text them back. Let's go to Lou, though. Lou has an employment law question. I think it's on the topic that the caller last hour had about life insurance after retirement. Lou from Lockport. Hello, Lou. Sorry. Thanks for holding on for so long, buddy.
Hello, John.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I turned 65 on this past Monday.
Congrats.
And on Tuesday, I got an email from HR. They provide free whole life insurance policy, but they're reducing the amount of my coverage because I'm over 65 now.
Interesting. And you're still employed, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, just making sure. And so you're 65, the company you're working for says, now that you're 65, the amount of coverage is going down. Patrick, have you heard of that?
Yeah, yes, and that's probably okay. But again, we have to go back to the plan and see what the company's allowed to do. But that's not nearly as concerning to me as the other issue we talked about.
Where they promise you life insurance.
Yeah, and they just pulled the plug.
Health insurance,
and they pulled the plug.
Yeah, that might be an actuarial table thing that the
companies
offer.
Yeah, I'm not as troubled by that at all.
Lou might be troubled by it, though, Patrick.
No, I understand.
Show some empathy.
I'm just saying contractually, I'm not as troubled. I'm very troubled for Lou. Yes, Mike.
Yeah, no, I think that might be just a thing that happens. We'll have to look a little more into it, Lou. Doesn't seem entirely fair, but again, actuarial tables are what they are.
Yeah.
Mike, do you have a thought on this?
It's all going to come down to contractual. That's a key question. Have they showed you or cited to you the provision that says, this is why, like section 14.2 says this? I mean, have they shown you something like that?
They didn't in the email, but I can certainly research it a little bit.
Yeah,
it's a starting point.
I would definitely request it. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
for sure.
Absolutely request that and then take a look at it and then call someone esteemed like Patrick to get their take on it.
Yeah, Lou, why not ask them for some documentation? You know, where in the company rules did it say this and et cetera, et cetera. And then if anything seems a little squirrely, you call Patrick Dolan. Okay, Lou?
All right. Thanks, John. Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Thanks, Lou.
Esteemed was in quotation marks.
Yeah, Patrick. I know. I saw your air quotes.
You see the air quotes?
I saw your air quotes, yeah.
Boom, boom.
815, I went back to teaching at age 60, and I taught for 15 years.
Nice.
How cool is that? I love this. So there's still hope for me to maybe be a law. You're always on me, Mike, to go to law school and become a lawyer.
If I'm in this booth in a couple of years and you're still having a discussion, we might have to do something to you.
Pull the plug.
Yeah.
Pull the plug on something.
Might have to finally elevate Iridian to host. I mean, she's been in the wings for way too long. Way too talented. John's kept her down for too long.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, look at this. I have to take a commercial break here. I'm 720 WGN. An insurance agent chimed in on the text line. They say that typically on a group life policy, like ones that employers have, the coverage amount is reduced at age 65. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem fair. It seems like it should be the opposite, but that's contractual.
Yeah.
And so there's probably no way to contest it. But
it's because they're
going
to make less money.
Yeah. And I don't like Hagee, you know, taking over our show when he's not here.
John, I was impressed. You connected all those dots. That was pretty good, all that. You just kind of like, you know.
It wasn't that much of a reach. We just talked about estate planning.
Know,
it was right in front of me.
Still.
Wow. How many times when I'm not here are you reading things about me? Zero. Zero. I want equal time. Hagee.
You got to pay more money.
Whoever you are,
I was just
going to
say,
pay more money.
John Hagee, his check's clear. So
ooh.
Yours don't, Mike Leonard. No, I'm just kidding.
You bring sandwiches, though.
And I say that, and we joke about the checks. But John Hagee's a great guy. Have you guys met John? He just started coming back on the show. He was on a couple years ago. He's an excellent resource, and he's great. HageeLaw.com, and he's a great. You know, honestly, he's the one that explained the difference between a will and trust to me in the first place. When I heard about estate planning, the first thing I thought of was like kings and queens and grand estates. And he really finds a way to break it down for people. In other words, he's a really great resource to our listeners. Unlike whatever this show has been today, so whatever the past 90 minutes have been, I don't know if they were quite as resourceful.
Scintillating.
Well, they know where to get a good sandwich. Now they know.
Insightful. I mean, yeah.
Dough Brothers.
I don't want to start another topic because we got Sylvia's news coming up, and I want to get to it on time. So let's, before the last half hour, one more time, who should be reaching out to you, Patrick, and how can they reach you?
Anybody with a workplace issue, 312-332-7800.
Okay, and Mike Leonard?
Anyone being investigated for a crime or contacted by law enforcement or charged with a crime at the state or federal level. Also, we represent on the civil side whistleblowers, and as we talked about today, we represent, defend individuals in university and college proceedings.
And the phone number?
312-380-6559.
For better or worse, 30 minutes more with these guys after the news on WGN. 236 on WGN. Mike Leonard is a federal defense attorney. Patrick Dolan, an employment lawyer. You can pepper those two with questions, or me, I suppose, though I'm not a lawyer. 312-981-7200. Mike Leonard, you want to talk a little NIL? You always love talking NIL stuff. Yeah. And boy, this is a crazy field that just keeps on getting crazier. For those that don't know what NIL, name, image, likeness, this is college players getting paid essentially by booster programs or by local advertisers. And it's a way to attract students in the transfer portal or right out of high school to become a part of their university.
Yeah, so it's kind of taken an interesting twist the last couple of weeks. There's been a couple of lawsuits filed by schools where a player will say, okay, I'm going to go into the transfer portal, meaning I can, cause it's kind of like being a free agent.
Yep.
Basically, I'm going to see what other schools are interested in me, and more importantly, what money are they offering me?
Okay? Right, there used to be a penalty for transferring way back in the day, right? You'd have to sit for a year.
Yeah.
And that is all gone now.
No, now it's crazy. So a college player can put their name in during certain time periods, and it's basically like open free agency. They put their name into it's called the transfer portal. See what interests other schools have, see what kind of money they're being offered to go to a different school. And then ultimately, you know, sometimes a player will sign a contract at the school they're at.
And now it's not money from the university.
Correct. So it's a weird thing. Like, the money isn't directly from the university. It's from usually what's called a collective, meaning a fundraising body, which raises a lot of money.
The boosters.
And then can pay players. For example, quarterback could make, you know, a couple $1 million. That's what happened in this last, you know, championship series. A guy at Miami, the quarterback, had a couple $1 million deal. He had played at Georgia, and then he was at Miami. But in any event,
and usually it's in exchange for services like promoting a cause that the nonprofit advocates for. That's the mask of
it. Yeah, it's somewhat of a joke. The idea, I think, when they invented this was actually the player would be doing something in exchange for the money. But they're really just being paid to play at that school. And so it's creating some big disparities because there are some schools that are great at raising money and some that aren't. And so, but what has happened recently, there's been some lawsuits filed and some injunctions filed where schools say, hey, look, like Duke filed a lawsuit against their own player, a quarterback, trying to enjoin him.
Say that again.
Yeah, so the Duke quarterback, who's very good and was very sought after.
Mm-hmm. Illinois beat Duke this year, by the way, but keep going.
Okay, well, we'll talk about Iowa later, but that's a higher plane. But anyways, the guy who was a very successful quarterback at Duke had a lot of opportunities to go other places and make a lot of money, still as a college player, and so, but signs a contract essentially to stay at Duke for a certain amount of money, and then, but then announces, no, I'm going to a different school because obviously the economic opportunity was better. And the interesting thing is you have cases now, including this Duke case, where the school will sue the individual saying essentially, really trying to enjoin them from leaving, which I think they're never going to succeed on that.
But the player didn't sign with Duke on a contract, did they?
No, I don't think technically it is. But, you know, whoever the body is suing, they're trying to stop them from leaving, which I believe they'll never legally succeed because the court's not going to say you must play for or you must be employed by this entity. You might have an action for breach of contract, that you breached the contract and therefore, you know, how do you prove your damages? How do you prove your monetary damages? Which could be very difficult. But I don't think any court's going to enjoin a player and say you must stay and play for the school. You can't breach your contract because that's really unheard of in contract law. But it is interesting. And I think it's a bad strategic move because other players are like, why would I want to go to this school forever if they're going to sue me if I want to leave?
Plus, what's the end game? Nope, you have to stay at Duke. We messed you up with this other opportunity you had. Now, please go play well for us.
Yeah.
I'd be like, well, interception. Right. Well, I mean, like, honestly.
It doesn't sound like you're a gamer, John.
No.
I think that would be called illegally throwing the game, but, you know, that's a different story. But
that's not a crime.
I thought that was interesting, but clearly there's going to be more litigation over the player movements, and there's going to have to be legislation at the NCAA level or otherwise to kind of come up with some way to even the ground so that one school like a Texas or a Florida or whoever who can maybe raise $30 or $40 or $50 million versus some other school that can only come up with $2 or $3 million, it's going to create these great disparities. It's already happening as we speak. It's already happened.
I do find it so fascinating that all of this came from a Supreme Court ruling, which I believe was a 9-0 ruling with a conservative court. Justice Roberts, I think, yeah, it was his court, of course. I mean, that's been the court for a while, but I think it was all of them, the majority. Yeah, it was a unanimous case, a ruling that these schools could not prevent these kids from making money.
Well, I think
young adults.
Yeah, because if you look at it back then, the issue really was, okay, look at the unfairness of a university who, while the player's there, makes all this money off their name, image, and likeness. They can sell their jersey. They can have their name on their jersey and sell it. And here the student is getting nothing out of those proceeds, out of that revenue. So I think at that time, a court like the Supreme Court was looking at it in the pure way, like, oh, this is unfair. They're using their name, image, and likeness, and the player's not getting a cut. I don't think they could have anticipated it would create this sort of free agency.
They were warned. You know, but it was also, I think it's like an antitrust thing, like that these schools could come together and prevent this collectively from happening. I would strike it down more as an antitrust thing than they have the right to earn something. Or either way, I think it'd be easy to strike down. Yeah. I think they made the right call, and it's not really for them, the Supreme Court, to figure out how to manage this. This is up to the NCAA and these schools to figure it out.
Correct, but it's going to come back to court because first somebody like the NCAA is going to try to put rules or regulations in place, or schools can, I think, much more far-fetched, voluntarily agree to some guidelines, but they're not going to because the haves are not going to agree that, hey, we have all this money to pay players. Let's agree with you that we shouldn't or there's a cap. But, you know, someone like Mark Cuban, who's donating now a lot of money to the Indiana program, he's in favor of caps because he knows basically otherwise it's a race to whoever can get the money each year.
What about
including his money?
There's been also Supreme Court cases, including one involving Northwestern, about considering these employees, considering these players employees. Couldn't one way out of this would be to allow all NCAA players to consider themselves to be employees, to join a union, and then a collective bargaining agreement between the NCAA and the players of NCAA sports could come up with the rules and regulations that would help navigate this a bit more?
I guess it's
possible. Is that a way out of it, or no?
I mean, schools are really not in favor of that at all. Mandating that these players can join unions and create unions, and that's going to be very difficult on the universities. You brought up IU. I think that's sort of ironically, I guess, a silver lining because now you can have a school like IU come out of nowhere. It's not Alabama, Georgia, you know, fill in the blank of Ohio State, Michigan, and a school like Indiana. Probably thanks to Mark Cuban, can come out of nowhere and win a national championship. Is that a bad thing or a good thing? I don't know.
Sure.
It's kind of both, frankly.
Yeah, and that wasn't so much a pure money thing. In the Indiana case, it was the fact that they were very smart of how they used this free agent transfer portal in that they got players who'd played a lot of college football. You know, guys who had played 4 years who were 23, 24 years old, had a lot of football under their belt, and it wasn't so much the money, that's certainly a factor, but they got people who had a lot of experience. Let's focus on guys who are 22, 23 years old, who've played 4 years. Let's bring them here, and that's a huge advantage. And that was a very smart use of the pool.
Yeah, but you know what? A lot of schools were after Fernando Mendoza, and so I'm certain he probably went to the highest bidder. That's what I'm saying. I think that's sort of a good. I think that's a good result of what we're talking about. So we're not looking at the same three or four teams every single year.
608 chimes in. Hi, John, Patrick, and Mike. I will tell you that my husband has been a season ticket holder for Badgers basketball for years and has become increasingly disenchanted with the whole transfer system and just about ready to give up the tickets. He has been a season ticket holder since 1964. What a sad situation, not college basketball. It's more like pro basketball. Thank you. I hear that argument, and I get it. I think we all long for the purity that college football and basketball and the other sports provided, but at the cost of what? I think these players legally should be allowed to do everything that they're doing right now. And does it make me hearken for the days of yesteryear? Maybe a little bit, but legally, I don't think it was right to ever prevent these people from making money in the first place.
But what we all know is Kentucky basketball, Duke basketball. I mean, why did students go there? So much is going. I don't mean to disparage them in specifically, but so many schools were paying these guys under the table to come there. Everybody knew it.
Yeah. So are you now talking about University of Illinois?
Yeah, no.
No, but yeah, the bummer for the caller's point is a great point, because look, someone goes to, a freshman comes to Wisconsin, Madison, or any other Big Ten school, even Iowa, whatever, and they have a great year. They might have a great freshman year, a great sophomore year, and then, of course, they're looking to go somewhere else because someone wants to pay them money. And obviously, solicitation goes on. But regardless whether they're solicited or not, all of a sudden, they're at this program. You're a fan. You watch this guy grow and develop. And then all bunch of money, they're gone. And you have a whole new team. And that can happen year after year, which is very frustrating from a fan standpoint. And I think we can't eliminate the fact that that's going to hurt college sports as well. From that standpoint,
you know, can we start signing multi-year contracts? Like, how is NIL done? Is it only just a one-year thing?
You could, but doesn't mean the person couldn't breach the contract and go somewhere, and doesn't mean the school you're going to couldn't pay.
Wait, then employment lawyer. Wait, why couldn't I hold someone to a contract that they signed with us, a non-compete?
Yeah,
is it just because there's all these different states with all these different laws, or why aren't non-competes enforceable in NIL transfer portals?
I think there is an antitrust issue there. They're not employees. Non-compete laws don't protect them the way they are, right? Okay. They're not employees, so they have no non-compete protection.
Yeah, so it becomes just a breach of contract case. But let's say a student's at one school and he wants to breach a contract. Let's say he's making $1 million. He's a star quarterback and someone's going to pay him two. He's going to break the contract he has with his school or his NIL collective and go somewhere else and get paid more. And there's nothing to stop the other school or collective to pay the monetary difference to the other school if it's a breach of contract case. So, but no court's going to tell somebody you must play for or you must be employed by this person. Not going to make you work or make you play.
I see.
But you have a breach, you have monetary damages.
But could they stop that person from playing on the other team?
I don't think so, no.
I don't think so either.
To try to enjoin someone, say you must play here, you can't play there, that's never going to happen. But they could find them in breach of the contract, which the remedy is monetary damages.
Then make them all employees.
But then the other part. But then
the schools don't want that.
No, they don't. They'll never want that.
They won't.
Absolutely not. Then they have to. They have to collectively bargain with those quote unionized players. It's not going to happen.
But if it's beneficial to the entire system, if everyone thinks that this is now bonkers the way basketball and football is run, won't these schools see the upside for giving some law and order to this?
I'm not sure every school does think it's bonkers, because I use a perfect example. Maybe they thought it was before, but now it works for them. So if you've got somebody with a big bag of money who's willing to support X school that hasn't been involved in any kind of championship football, basketball, et cetera, there is your chance. So I don't think everybody's against it if you're a school at all.
773 yesteryear never was pure or without corruption when it comes to college sports, especially for the larger schools. Yeah, I personally don't care how. I think it's fine the way it is right now. I like the competitive nature of it. I like transfer portals. Go get the money, kids, young adults. That's what you're entitled to. It's your talents. It may sting you. You're making a very stingy face.
Because I don't like a lot of aspects of it, especially like the basketball is even a more stark example, as the call from Madison fan pointed out, because you only have 12 players on a team. And if you lose one or two stars a year, it's tough. It's like you're constantly starting over and, you know, you're
paying
more. Should that really be the denominator? Like, whoever just pays them the most.
I was going to say, what's the alternative? Honestly, I think it has to work. At least it's above board.
You could have what Cuban's talking about. You could possibly have this idea of
a cap,
institutional salary
caps.
That's
fine.
Yeah.
But that's going to have to be agreed to by, like, an under the table deal by all the universities, right?
It wouldn't be under the table. Either there's legislation or NCAA enforcement or whatever. I don't think NCAA can mandate that, but I think it's actually going to have to come through
Congress.
Yeah. I mean, they've actually talked about that.
Congress coming up and saying, here's a cap on how much you can make.
They've talked about things about college sports.
That should be unconstitutional. Why would Congress be able to limit any job field from a cap?
Because it affects interstate commerce,
for sure.
Yeah. It's a private industry.
But we've also seen an offshoot, which is kind of a different issue. But now,
let's take a pause.
Betting scandals.
We have to take this break. Yeah. Betting scandals. Mike's also got a question that I think is a good one, which I hope we can get to, but we got to hit this break. And then we have one more coming up on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. The show's running out of time, Mike Leonard. You had one point about betting, or should we go right to Mike on the phone line?
Let's talk to Mike.
Yeah, let's go to Mike. He's been holding a while. Hey, Mike, how are you doing today? Thanks for calling.
Hey, guys, how are you?
Good.
Hey, first time caller here.
Thank you.
Do we ring a bell for him, John?
Well, we don't have a bell.
Ding, 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 ding.
Mike, did you not hear me say we're almost out of time? Go ahead, Mike, the caller.
Yeah, I do. But, you know, I had a question, but I like what you guys were talking about earlier. And just to, if I just kind of come back to that.
Yeah.
So I'm a Spartan fan, and Mike knows this. And
caught
so
him.
I was just reading about, you know, Tom Izzo has really been very vocal about, you know, players and type in professional players coming back into college football. He's just another player. I was reading that Alabama's bringing a 3-year G League player back into Alabama, and there, I guess there was a court rule that stay until it goes through the court system. So it's a, you guys, some people like this. I think this is the wild, wild west.
It is.
I think I'm all for paying the players, but there's no rules now on who can play. So now if they're coming, pros coming back in basketball, how do you prevent pros from coming back into college who may be on a practice squad, who may have left a year or two of eligibility, and now they're suing to get, some folks are suing to get, you know, a 6-year eligibility on it, you know? So at what point do you guys kind of see that in the best interest or somewhere, I don't know if it's the court or if it takes to go, you know, it's time to go through the courts, it's going to be years. At what point is there like the best interest of the public come into play?
We
here
were just where, talking about this, Mike, because I don't think that this has risen to a level in which the public interest in our love of how college sports used to be rises to anyone doing anything about this. These are private companies, private institutions, or some public institutions, but competing against each other, money talks, players walk. And yeah, it may not be what we used to have, but that doesn't rise to the level of changing the laws or having Congress step in my book.
Disagree in my book. I hope that something can happen, although it's just tough, Mike, because NCAA doesn't really have the power or authority to do it. I don't think you're going to get voluntary cooperation amongst the schools because it is obviously a question of have and have nots, and why would the haves want to, you know, knock down the system? But there actually has been talk at the congressional level of doing something about it, and I think that's the only way that something
thing
can happen.
They ever took
up. But that's the only way it's going
to
happen.
To save our old love of how sports used to be in college?
That everything not, under the table.
That is not enough public interest for Congress to get involved.
I think it is. We'll see. Well, when we're in
nostalgia.
No, well,
on behalf of nostalgia for America, we're going to legislate how college players operate. That's stupid.
It affects interstate commerce.
No, this is all us being like, ooh, back in the day, I used to watch a freshman rise to the star. I get it. That was great. That is not the reality. You cannot legislate how much these people can be paid because we liked the way it used to be. All right.
We can.
Those days are gone.
Mike. Really quickly, phone number, Mike Leonard.
312-380-6559. And John, if you go to law school, don't call someone stupid.
Patrick Dolan, sorry.
312-332-7800.
And I know all you listeners disagree with me on this, and I'm okay with that.